Dr. J Interviews is a collection of candid conversations with good Black professional men regarding life and career choices. I'm your host, Dr. J McCarthy. Hey, I want to welcome to my show a good friend of mine, Mr. Curtis Millay. How you doing today, brother?
Hey, I'm doing good. Greetings, Dr. McCarthy.
I'm gonna let our guests know how we know each other a little bit later on. It's kind of a funny story, but let's just jump right into it, man. Tell these listeners, what do you do for a living?
So I work for a company called DJS International Logistics. My official title is I'm a senior customs broker. So what my company does is we work with U.S. companies handling their logistics from door to door. So we will pick up their goods from the factory, make sure that they get factory overseas, make sure that they get loaded onto an ocean vessel or an airplane or however they go, shipped to the United States. We work with U.S. Customs, FDA, USDA, and other government agencies to get the goods cleared into the United States, to get the duties paid, and then from there we handle final delivery from wherever the port is to the end customer, whether it be a distribution center or whatever it takes. And kind of ironically, it's kind of the same job that I did when I first went into the
company. Oh, how is that logistics business running right now with amidst all this COVID stuff that's going on?
You know, what's interesting is we had already, you know, when you look at, they always talk about the deficit imports to export. Mm-hmm. It was already starting to even out a little bit because of the extra duties that the new administration brought in. And then when COVID hit, it hit right during Chinese New Year. So at first there wasn't much impact because it's a down period for us anyway. Okay. Most of the accounts that I handle a couple of accounts that bring in food items, and then I handle some accounts that bring in more durable goods. So those accounts really didn't take much of a hit. There was a little bit of slowing because there was no space on vessels, mm-hmm. and cutting vessels off. But it started to pick up. Ironically, our last month was a pretty strong month. So it's just kind of up and down. The duties. The increased duties over the last year and a half or so actually hit us a little bit harder than COVID.
I got you. So young blood trying to get into logistics, is that something that a degree is required for?
Not the job that I do. That's the interesting thing about the job that I do. My degree is actually in business administration, and I was actually going to go into teaching.
Okay.
Coming out of school. But in international logistics, depending on what level you get in, I came in on the ground level. There's a lot of schools that do offer a degree plan in international logistics, mm-hmm. whether it be supply chain management or customs law or things of that nature. But to get in on the ground level, you know, because it's very much one of those jobs that's on the job training.
I got you.
So it's one that you can come in on the ground floor, you know, right out of high school. You're not going to make a lot of money coming out of the boat, but you know, right out of the block, if you're a hustler, if you stay with it, if you're good, if you got good customer service skills, mm-hmm. it's something you can jump right into.
So I got a buddy that I went to college with, actually was roommates for a little bit, and I believe he's in logistics. I heard it could be quite lucrative at different levels. Can you give people kind of a range? You know, you said it kind of starts off low, but can you give them like a window? What to expect?
So there's a couple different windows. Like with a lot of industries, it depends on what level you're on. Mm-hmm. So at the desk level, when you come at the desk level, if you're just an entry level clerk, you know, you're just shuffling papers and stuff like that. You know, right out of college, the pay's not that high. At the most, you're gonna make, you know, $30,000, $35,000. Mm-hmm. But you know, as you get a little longevity in it, as you move up through the ranks. If there's a lot of continuing education and certification, you can actually get your customer's brokerage license, which I don't have yet because I didn't need it at the time. Mm-hmm. So you know, once you break that next tier, then you kind of get into that $50,000 to $75,000 range. You know, once you get into management, you get into upper management. You know, that's when you start breaking the six figure range.
Oh yeah.
And then Coupled with that, you know, there's a sales side to it. So, you know, if you come into it sales, you know, you're making a salary for commission. So that commission, you know, runs the duration of an account. So most of the money is on the sales side.
Is that, are those certifications expensive? How much do those run usually?
It depends on how your company works it. So we have what's called customs specialist certification. We have to do 20 hours of continuing education every year.
Okay.
To keep the certification, I believe it's like $275 a year.
Okay.
And then the continued education, most of it is free. A lot of the little modules that you can take, it might be $40 or $50. My particular company, because they want us to have that continuing education, they pay for that.
Okay.
When you go to get your brokerage license, which is kind of that next level, the brokerage license is going to run you about $400 or $500.
Okay.
And then there's a whole class that goes along with it. But depending on who you get in with, and there's a lot of the companies in my industry will pay for your training once you get that level.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them will also pay for college courses.
Nice. So what's a typical day for Mr. Malay? You wake up and then look, the edited version.
Hey, I'll wake up and I hit the snooze button three times. You know, I work in operations. So my day is all about time management, document management, customer care. I've got one of those weird sort of personalities. So, you know, I deal with overseas, China, mainly China, some Europe. So most of my work that I get as far as overseas, I get overnight. So I get emails overnight. So my typical day, you know, I get up and before I even get to the office, you know, I'm kind of on the grind. I'm kind of an overachiever. But before I even get to the office, you know, I whip out my phone. I kind of go through my emails, see what I got overnight from overseas, put out any small fires, you know. And then once I get to the office, it's all customer service and management. I get customers calling me. You know, we're dealing with logistics.
Yeah.
We got Christmas right around the corner, so everybody's got their Christmas shipments coming in. So it's all about, hey, where's my stuff? When's it going to be here? You know, dealing with airlines and truckers, making sure everybody's where they're supposed to be. You know, typically my morning, the first part of my morning is spent prioritizing my work day because, you know, I'm what I like to call a productive slacker. You know, I try to line up my work so I can get it done in chunks. And, you know, once those big chunks are done, I kind of sit back and kind of let stuff come to me.
I gotcha.
You know, and then it kind of works like that. My week, you know, the way the shipping week works for me, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday are usually busy days.
Mm-hmm.
Once I get Thursday's usually pretty dead. That's my catch up day. And then Friday, I'm trying to push everything out, you know, for the weekend. I don't have a whole lot to do.
I gotcha. What's your favorite part of that day?
I'm a customer service guy. So anytime I'm a problem solver and I like solving problems. So when I get a customer that calls me and they're upset because, you know, a driver hasn't showed up somewhere or they're having trouble with customs or they've got an answer. So the favorite part of my day is dealing with customers. You know, when they call me, I complain about them. Don't get me wrong. You get a little bit of everything, but yeah. I like to solve problems. So, you know, when I get that phone call that says, hey, Curtis, you know, I'm having this issue, you know, I get my gratification from by the time we hang up on that phone call, my customer knows I've got him. We've got it taken care of and everything's going to be all right.
Yeah. So I think that's a good point to talk about how we met. And then we're going to piggyback on that and then go into what you do as a second job as well, because I think that's interesting. So to our listeners, I've known Mr. Malay for, 8 or 9 years now, possibly.
Yeah.
And so we had a local basketball rec association, and he was one of the commissioners. And I'd filled out the application because I wanted to coach. And for whatever reason, I don't know if they had enough coaches or not, I ended up getting put on a team got put on the team.
Was that the Super Mario team?
Yeah, Team Mario. Team Mario. So this guy, didn't know what he was doing, and I was trying to be a good player. I wanted to coach myself, but I'm like, I'll take a second seat. I help this guy out. And I was getting so frustrated. And I didn't know Curtis at the time. He was commissioned. We sent emails. He sent me one. And he was like, brother, how you doing? And I was like, I have to tell the edited version. The hell you think? Hell you think I'm doing? A team name is Team Mario. Right? And he laughed like that. And we have been cool ever since, right?
Yeah.
And the unique story about Curtis, this guy, he's mentored me in coaching. I really look at him as a brother. We're part of, we call ourselves the Mount Rushmore. There's a couple more of us as well.
Black Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, so he's taught me a lot about coaching. I've coached with him. He's coached my kids. I've coached his, man. We've had a good time over the years. And leading into what he also does on the side, do you want to introduce the other job that you do?
Yeah, so I'll kind of go back to the origin story. I had, my boys came up playing ball. So I coached for years. I actually, when I first got out of college and I was student teaching, I coached high school football. I coached youth baseball, basketball, football, and all that. So I coached my boys all the way through, and kind of when they got to the age where they had either aged out, the oldest aged out, and then, the youngest wasn't really into sports anymore, I transitioned into refereeing. And kind of ironically, just keep sort of short, the boys were aging out of sports. I had just got divorced. I had a lot of extra time on my hands. I needed time for it. So I went to a local football association and signed up to be a football referee. Just kind of side gig, man. I just wanted to work two or three games. And it turned into almost a full-time, part-time side hustle. Mm-hmm. So I referee youth sports. My primary sport is football. So I do high school football. I do it all the way down to Pee Wee, every division of Texas high school football, 1A through 6A. I've had a couple of side gigs that have kind of spun out of that. I work with the Big 12 during the season at their replay center, queuing up film and working with film for replay.
Yeah.
That has kind of become, coaching was my passion, mm-hmm. and it's what drove me and what kind of made me who I was. So me refereeing is kind of an extension of that, kind of next level.
I think we may have had, what was the count, 4 million some emails. I email this guy questions about, I get frustrated during the game and I get straight on that computer. I sit in my tab. Man, what's the rule for this?
Break
it down. Something else that's interesting that you do, I want to bring up. You told me before, do you still do the silver dollar? Or is it the dollar piece?
Yeah, man. Yeah. So that started. I'm a sports guy. So, I'm big on tradition. I'm big on superstition. I'm big on routine. So that started when I was a kid. When I was a little kid, my great grandmother, for our birthday, every birthday, you got a silver dollar. So she'd give us a silver dollar for her birthday. And I had no idea what happened to those silver dollars. So, as I got a little bit older, I got into this habit of I would always carry a silver dollar in my pocket. So you can catch me anywhere and I can guarantee you in my pocket, I'm going to have a tube of chapstick and a silver dollar. And I don't know how the tradition kind of started with kids, but when I started refereeing, it started with baseball. I was behind the plate and this joker cranked one out of the park, man. He hit it over the fence. So as he was rounding home plate and headed back to the dugout, I hollered at his number and I flipped him a silver dollar. Kid's face lit up. It was huge. So that kind of started me down that path. So in refereeing, I have my silver dollar with me, and if I see a kid that's hustling, or if I see a kid that sometimes you see that kid that's frustrated, mm-hmm. and he's just got his head down, I might give him a silver dollar to kind of pick his heads up. And I mean, from a 3-year-old T-baller to a 17-year-old high school football player, you give him that silver dollar and their eyes just light up and everybody wants to gather around them. They want to see them. Little kids call them big quarters, everybody wants to see him. So I would say, you know, in my officiating career, over the last 9 or 10 years, I have probably given out somewhere between $300 and $400.
And I attested it. I've seen it. So
yeah, and I'll tell you another funny story. My niece, who lives in Italy, they were at the beach and the car got broken into. This just happened last month. Mm-hmm. And the thing she was most distraught about was they stole her little pocketbook that had the silver dollar that I gave her when she was a little kid. So I just sent her a silver dollar last week that she just got. She was over the moon.
Wow. What is the, and that we've had talks about this too, because my sons were interested in it. What's the pay for referees? I know it varies depending on like the sport. And
so
if someone wanted to get into it.
Like I said, it's one of those things that you get out of what you put into it. So, you know, for youth games, you know, any youth game almost all the way up to high school, you're going to make between $35 and $50. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, you're earning it. Because, you know, if you're doing football, you're running up and down the field, baseball, you know, you're out in the heat, basketball, you run up the court. But, you know, when you look at $35 to $50 a game, if you're a hustler, you know, on a Saturday, just as a young kid doing baseball games or basketball games, you do 10 games in a day, you know, you make $350 if you only make $35.
Yeah.
With high school football, it's a little bit different because we have a pay scale that's set by UIL. Mm-hmm. So we get, on average, $55 a game plus $12 travel. And then for high school football games, I think it's like $125 minimum. But then it's prorated based on the gate. So if you're working a big game, you know, like a DeSoto game, a South Lake game, and it's a big gate, you know, those checks can be, you know, $200, $300, $400. I worked Denton Guyer against Alito for the first game of the season. You know, full house.
Yeah.
That was like a $375 check. I thought they sent me the check for everybody that worked the game. So it threw me off. And you know, like I said, it's become a full-time, part-time career. So, you know, just at my level, I'm just at the high school level. And then with my side gig, you know, that's a pretty substantial chunk of extra income.
Yeah.
Now, if you keep on progression through the college ranks, you know, I got a buddy that calls for the Big 12 and one that's in the SEC, you know, I'm catching making $3,500,
$4,500
a day.
Wow.
Saturday worth of work. Of course, they've got to put in all the work on the backside.
Yeah.
You know, being an official, it's year round. You're in clinics, you're in the rule book, you know, you're always on the grind studying.
Yeah. See, I pride myself, and I say this with a smirk on my face, that I never got a flagrant before. How do you guys deal with that, man? I mean, it is so much from, I see other coaches, you know, I hear the stuff from the stands and people living through their kids, and it's just, and we've had offline conversations about that.
Yeah.
How do you manage that? What do you hold on to keep your civility?
So, you know, what's funny is I've probably got more technicals that have been assessed to me than I've given out. and you've seen my boy Parker play.
Yeah.
You know, Parker was a technical machine. So, but you know, the thing about it, and one thing I'd like people to take away from, because you get all this advice, and like, you know, the thing about it with me is I'm always me. I mean, you know how my temperament is. Mm-hmm. And you know, one thing that happens when we go into the world is the world tries to make you what it thinks it wants you to be. You know, as a referee, when you walk into the stadium, it's the only job that I've ever had where you're the most hated person in the room when you walk in. And the world wants you to be that bad guy.
Yeah.
So you got to stay true to who you are. And I'm not just talking about your principles. I'm talking about your personality, you know, how you handle things. So, you know, the way I handle it with coaches, I had a guy, you know, a few years ago, he told me, he said, if I have to flag a coach or if I have to give a coach a technical, I haven't done my job. I haven't managed the game and I haven't controlled myself. You know, there are times when you have to do that, but you know, some guys are hot-headed. They got a short trigger.
Yeah.
So, you know, with me, the first thing is I know my stuff. Mm. I know what I'm talking about. And it's funny, I had this conversation with somebody the other day. When you know what you're talking about, even when you don't know what you're talking about, you sound like you know what you're talking about. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, my first step is I know my stuff. I'm tight. When I walk on the field, my uniform is tight. The way I handle people is tight. You know, the way I deal with players and coaches is tight. So if they come to me and they're upset, I'm not just responding off the top of my head.
Exactly.
I'm responding from a place of knowledge of what I know. And then if I don't know it, I just don't speak on it. Coach, I'll get back.
Yeah.
You know, and then if that doesn't work, you know, I defer to my personality. I can laugh and I can joke with people. You know, I can bring them down. And then from there, it just goes to crisis management skills. You know, being able to have a conversation with somebody when they don't want to have a conversation. You know, coaches get paid to holler. That's what coaches get paid to do. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They holler at the bus driver for being late. You know, they holler at the trainers for water. They holler at the players for not making plays. You know, they go home and they holler at their wife when they lose a game. So they're supposed to holler at me. That's their job to holler. Right? So, you know, my job is to be able to still do my job, you know. Now, parents, that's a whole different, you know, parents are parents. There's a lot of different techniques you can use to deal with parents. But I usually defer to, I give them a little bit of my personality. I give them a little bit of humor. I'm in charge of our chapter for recruiting and retention. So I'm in charge of recruiting new referees.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm quick. I've got these little wristbands, you know, that have our website on. And if they don't like what's going on, I'm like, boom, boom, boom. Here. Hey, come on out. Come on out. Come do better.
I hear you. Speaking of like yelling coaches, I was watching. I think I texted you too. I was watching Last Chance U last night, and it's in Oakland.
Yeah.
And I was like, as soon as I saw it was in Oakland, I thought about you. So
okay.
I think that's a good pivot point, man. Let's talk about your childhood and how you got to where you are. So can you start telling me about your childhood? Just start with your adolescent years.
So I'm originally from California. Both of my parents are from Little Rock, Arkansas. And they both grew up in Little Rock, you know, in the middle of the civil rights movement and the end of segregation and all that. So that's kind of their background.
Okay.
My great-grandmother was born a sharecropper. Her mother was a freed slave. So, you know, I bring that up because that all kind of plays into, you know, who I am and how I deal with it.
Yeah.
My parents were high school sweethearts. My dad, when he graduated from high school, went into the Air Force. Him and my mom got married. My older sister was born overseas in England. My dad was stationed. He came back stateside and settled in Oakland, California because his brother. So I was born in Oakland in the 70s, which was probably one of the greatest generations ever. Great time to be in Oakland. You know,
yeah.
In the 70s, you know, you're only 2 years removed from Dr. King being assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
The Black Panthers are getting started. I actually, as a young kid, when I was right before I started school, I was actually in one of the Black Panther Head Start programs.
Nice.
Ironic. My father's a policeman. My father worked for Alameda County Sheriff's Department for 33 years. He retired from the Sheriff's Department. And what's kind of neat is that at one point in his career, he was the highest ranking Black law officer in the state of California.
Wow.
So my mom and dad divorced when I was really young. I'm named after my father and my uncle. And so I go by Curtis. But my whole family calls me Tony by my middle name. You know, we moved up to Northern California after my parents got divorced. And then eventually my mom, she wanted to be closer to her family. Her parents were getting a little bit older. So she wanted to be closer to her family in Little Rock, but she didn't want to be in Little Rock. So she almost literally threw a dart at a map and wound up in San Antonio. So, and for a young man, I don't think it could have happened at a worse time in life. Yeah. You know, I'm just now starting high school. You know, I'm going through that whole thing. You know, my mom had just divorced her second husband, so we're going through that turmoil. And not only am I going to a new school, I'm going to a whole new state. And I hated coming to because, you know, from California, when you come east, it's like stepping back in time.
Yeah.
You know, so I hated it. So I landed in San Antonio as a freshman.
Wow.
You know, I'm a big guy now, but as a freshman, dude, I was 9 pounds. But I still had 200 pounds worth of mouth. So, you know, I started playing football, and I spent most of my freshman year just getting beat up. And I had my helmet, my freshman football helmet, had more scratches on the back of it than it did on the front of it. These guys would just roll me in the dirt,
yeah.
You know. And it was because I was struggling, you know, to kind of figure out who I was. You know, yeah. My mom was a single parent. You know, I'm at home with, I got two sisters, my mom. We weren't living in the best part of San Antonio, so I didn't have a whole lot of male role models. So yeah. My coaches, to this day, Coach Finley, who was my head coach, Coach Bird, who was my position coach, they were like my dad. And during football season, they kept me in check. Coach Finley left the school right at the end of my freshman year to go back to his hometown coach. And I broke down. I was in tears because I didn't know what that was my role model.
Yeah.
So then my sophomore year, once football season was over, I started getting in trouble because I didn't have that guidance. I didn't have that channel. I didn't have that structure. So I started getting in a lot of trouble when, you know, my mom was tired of me and, you know, I wasn't listening. So I know you heard this story before. My mom loves to tell it. My mom got so fed up with me, she moved without me. She literally moved without me. You know, I hook up with my partners. I'm gone for the weekend. I'm out. I'm doing my thing. I come back to the apartment on Sunday, you know. Dude, they're not a stick of furniture. Not a wow. stick of furniture in their apartment. You know, I don't know what to do. I go back to my buddy's house, and my mom sent local officer over to pick me up. And then she came and got me. And she moved me from one side of San Antonio uh-huh. all the way to the north side where the buses didn't run. And she's like, you live here now. You're going to make this work or I'm going to kill you. You know, that was the way it worked. And literally, you know, in that break in my sophomore year, I went from straight D's and a C in football to all A's and B's just from that one little switch. So she had a master plan and she made it work. So moved over there, graduated from high school. I didn't know what I was going to do. I'm like, I know you're going to interview a whole lot of guys that were plugged in from the beginning. You know, they were stellar students in high school. They were athletes. They knew where they were going. They knew what they were going to do. I had like, and complicate things. At the end of my senior year, my girlfriend got married. She was only a sophomore. And that's a whole nother story.
Yeah.
She dropped out of high school, had the baby, went back to school, got her nursing certificate, and she's a PhD now.
Wow.
So that's a whole separate success story.
Yeah.
But so I didn't know what I was going to do. And my senior year, my mom was dating an Army recruiter. And kind of on the sly, without her knowing, I enlisted in the Army. So I left for basic training within that week after I graduated from high school, which was one of the biggest transition points of my whole life. Joining the Army literally made me what I am today. Mm-hmm. I went into the Army. I didn't know how to tie. I'd never been home. I had a limited number of male role models that I was around on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
So that whole transition of going from mama's little nest, you know, it was a safe spot. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say mama's rough. You've met mama before. You know, she was hard on us. But I went from mama's nest, you know, right into the grease in the Army. And it changed my whole life. It just sent me on a whole nother trajectory. So I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew if I went into the Army, I could get away from home mm-hmm. and I could pay for college.
Exactly.
So I did that. I spent 4 years on active duty. Got out. My mom had gotten remarried and moved to the DFW area. So that's kind of where I settled. I've been there
What did the now you had mentioned earlier that part of what you learned in the military helped you with logistics right now. What did you do while you were in the military?
So my first job in the military, I was at 88 November, and that's traffic movement coordinator. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they basically work at airports, on railheads and seaports. They facilitate loading cargo. They facilitate load manifest, moving cargo from one place to another, getting vehicles from one place to another. So it was basically in the logistics bay. You know, my first job, my first assignment, I went to Germany. I was over in Germany. I worked at Ramstein Air Force Base. I worked on the flight line. And, you know, my whole job on the flight line was doing flight manifest, getting people on flights, moving them back to safety. So, ironically, the way the circle of life worked, you know, when I got into logistics, it fed back into what I did with.
That's what's up. And then you did, how many years in the Army did you do before you went to school? You enrolled in college after that, right?
So as soon as I got out of the Army again, I was a little bit, you know, didn't quite know what I wanted to do. Relocated here, took a couple classes at Tarrant County Junior College, what it was called at the time. And my sister was graduating from high school. And she got a scholarship to run track at San Houston State. Hmm. So my mom was like, why don't you just go down to San Houston State? With your sister. So I went down to San Houston State, which was another major pivot point in my life. Because again, I'm a smart guy, mm-hmm. but I wasn't a guy that was going to spend all his time in the library. So, you know, I enjoyed college and college life and everything that it had to offer. And for me, coming from San Antonio, which is primarily Hispanic and Caucasian, mm-hmm. When I got to Sam Houston, and then, you know, the Army was just kind of a little bit of everybody. When I got to Sam Houston, you know, I was immersed in the Black community, you know, because we were each other's family while we were down there.
Yeah.
So that was another pivot point in my life that became a brother of Alpha Phi Alpha Incorporated.
I was, you know, I was leading to that. I saw your bracelet.
Yeah, that black and all gold, which everything that the Army taught me about being a man, becoming a member of a fraternity kind of built on that. The guys that I was around, the way we handled our business, the way we did things, kind of built it.
Okay, that's what's up. And now, you know, I know a little bit about you. You have a son that's in your baby son. What's he in his first? Yeah. First year?
He just finished his freshman year. Okay. He was at Texas State University down in San Marcos. Loved it down there. Great campus. He's going into physical therapy.
Nice.
During with the whole COVID thing, having to come home, you know, we always preach the power of connections. You know, that's another thing that we don't teach our youngsters at a young level, mm-hmm. that other races seem to teach, but through the power of connection and knowing somebody, mm-hmm. he got a job as a physical therapist at a hospital up in Denton.
Nice.
So with the whole COVID thing and not knowing whether he wanted to go back to San Marcos and since learning was going to be online, and he didn't want to give up his job in Denton, mm-hmm. he's transferring to North Texas.
Nice. He's going to go to North Texas. Go put you on the spot a little bit here. Something that I admire about you, and I think that is very unique. You're a very well-traveled person. So can you tell us, aside from the military, how many countries have you visited?
Oh, man, I can't tell you. I've been to Germany just this Christmas with my mom and the crew. We went to Italy to see my sister, which is probably one of the greatest trips I've ever been on. We were in Rome and Naples. I got married. My ex-wife is from Trinidad and Tobago, so I got married in the Caribbean. I've been to Aruba, I've been to Nicaragua, I've been to Canada, spent some time in Honduras. I haven't made it to Asia yet. That's on my list. Mm-hmm. I've been all over the United States, of course. You know, Hawaii, Alaska. I've actually, one of the things, like with my sons are pretty well traveled too. You know, we were kind of blessed having a mom that works in the airline industry. So, you know, my sons have been to Thailand, in China. And one of our things is to be able to dip our feet in as many bodies of water as possible.
I like that.
I've done the Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, the Gulf of Mexico. My sister lived up in Washington, up near Schwim, and Port Angeles is the furthest northern contiguous point in the United States. So I've been there. I've just been lucky. You know, I spent a week in Nicaragua, just kind of rolling around, living off the land.
Yeah.
You know, and I actually went down there for a funeral, but it kind of turned into a whole culture experience. That was an amazing thing. When I was in the Army Reserve, I spent some time down in Honduras, Golden Road.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I've been a bunch of different places. Not as many places I'd like to go. My passport actually expires next year, and I'm hating having to turn it in and give up all my stamps.
Yeah. I tell you, I think that it's very important, and you can probably attest to this, let me just ask you that, I guess. As far how important do you think that is for a brother, especially our people, because we're kind of, when it comes to travel, we're a little bit more suspect, you know, we're a little bit more reserved at exposing yourself to seeing different cultures and different viewpoints and changing who you are.
So here's the thing. We like to travel. Brothers like to travel. We'll go to Jamaica in a heartbeat.
Yeah, that's true.
We'll go to Cabo San Lucas in a heartbeat. But there's a difference between traveling and travel. You know, me and my boys have this thing. We like to get it on. Mm-hmm. We like to feel it. Because you get to feel how the world works, how other people see. You know, when I went to Italy for Christmas, Parker and I just took a day and just hung out in Rome. And we were at this little cafe eating lunch. And a guy from the Netherlands, an older guy, he was in his 60s or 70s, and his wife was sitting at the table next to him. And they just out of the blue strike up a conversation. So now we're talking, we're in Rome, you know, talking to a guy from the Netherlands about the U.S., about the Netherlands. And you get that experience. My boys and I had an interesting trip to Canada. We wound up in Canada by accident. We got stranded in Washington and couldn't get back. And I tell my boys, keep your passport with you. And the lady working the gate was like, well, we can fly you through Vancouver and then fly you home from Vancouver. And I said, well, can you get me a late flight out of Vancouver so we can spend the day in Vancouver?
Nice.
And she said, yeah. And so we got in late at night, and before the boys got up, I got up, you know, I got online, I saw what was around us, and, you know, we went to the library, we went to the mall, we snuck into a hockey game, you know, we went to the museum. So the thing about us traveling is, we got to teach our younger people that the world doesn't end at the tip of your nose. It doesn't end, you know, at the sidewalk. I have a stepdaughter that she had never been on a train. So one day, you know, we got on the train and we rode the train to Fort Worth. And then we rode the train to Dallas and we walked around. And I was explaining to her, you can take a train to anywhere you want to go in the world. Because you can catch a train in downtown Dallas and take that to a transportation hub in Fort Worth. And then you can get on Amtrak and you can take that Amtrak to LA. And then you can get on a boat or a plane from LA and fly to wherever the hell you want.
Yeah.
You know, all you got to do is have a little adventure in you and go out. So, you know, when you talk about traveling, I think what we need to preach is immersing yourself,
yes,
in other cultures.
I like it.
You know, getting it on you. And that's what teaches you those interpersonal skills to deal with other people. Yes. That's what gives you a love of where you are. You know, I loved Italy. Italy's a great country, but they have the worst bathrooms in the world. You know, so I was happy to come back to the United States to my American standard toilet.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. It gives you an appreciation of, and then what it does is it connects you to people. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know how many times when I've been on a sideline and I'll get to talking to a coach or something, and all of a sudden they're like, yeah, no, I've been to Nicaragua, you know, I've been here. And that connects you to a bigger body of people. It's all about connecting yourself to the world and to the universe and getting it on you and living life in your present.
I like that, brother. I love that. All right, so at this point, we get to the point of this where we ask three questions I ask all my guests on the show.
Okay.
So the first one, of course, you know, our past and mold who we are, you know, some things I think it was necessary for us to go through. But if you could go back, what type of advice would the older you give to the younger you?
The best advice I could give to myself would be to be diligent and be true to who you are. I you know, one thing we don't talk about is as Black men is mental health. And part of that feeds into who you are. As a Black male, you're always told you got to be a little less thick. You got to be a little more thick. You got to speak a little bit more like this, a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my biggest downfall as a young man was I was always trying to change myself, who I was, to fit a situation. And then you get discouraged if you never always quite get it, and then you feel disingenuous to yourself and you miss out on opportunities.
Yeah.
So most of the opportunities that I've missed out on in life have been because I wasn't true to who I was. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So if I could go back and give myself, you know, some advice, I'd tell myself, hey, be diligent. Be true to who you are and use your personality, use your mind, use who you are to propel you to the next.
Okay. Nice. Okay. So the second question, and you know this from me, we've talked so much. I'm a big proponent of strengthening one's mind, body, and spirit. So can you share what you do to personally strengthen either one or all three of those areas?
So as you can tell from the body, I'm a little bit lacking there. I actually had this talk with my sons during when the lockdown first started. You know, in the first couple of days, being in logistics, I was labeled essential. So I only spent like 2 days at home.
Mm-hmm.
The rest I was in the office. But I'm always, you know me, I'm always on the go. I got something to do. Always got something to do. So that first day or that second day, man, I was laying on the floor looking at the ceiling fan. And I was like, 5 o'clock at night to 9 o'clock at night lasts about 32 hours. I didn't know what to do with myself.
Yeah.
And then I told myself, you have got to keep your mind and your soul engaged. You know, you've got to keep yourself engaged. I'm a huge reader. I read the news all day long. When I was younger, I used to read 3 newspapers a day. And you've got to look at ways to engage your brain just to keep it active.
Yeah.
And you've got to vary how you engage it. You know, if you're a reader, you can't always read the same thing. You can't always read romance novels. You can't always read nonsense. You gotta keep your brain active. And you gotta keep your body active. It could be something little like, you know, I have to force myself to say, okay, I've been sedentary for this amount of time. I've gotta get up and get myself active. I was going to the gym on a regular basis on the treadmill, but you know, because of the way things are, I can't do that. So I've got to be kind of intentional about how I get keep myself active.
Okay.
That means going out and taking a walk around the block, you know, just something to get fresh air, get the blood moving, and feed your brain. I always knew about it, and I found out about it during the lockdown. There's you can take audit courses. You know, I took an audit course on COVID and contact tracing through Johns Hopkins University.
Wow.
For free. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, you got places like Harvard and Penn State that have these courses and you know, just throw a dart, pick up. They got these courses in economics and religion, you know, and law that you could take on an audit basis. Even if you don't finish it, even if you just skim through it to activate your brain. And then there's the spiritual side of it. You know, people exercise their spirituality in different ways. And however way works for you, you know, some people it's meditation. some people it's a daily reading. I have an alarm on my phone that goes off every day. It's the noon prayer break. Usually I just turn it off. I'm not diligent about actually saying that prayer at noon.
Yeah.
But just seeing that, that prayer break,
mm-hmm.
I can tell you, we talked about work, where I've been on the phone, or I've been dealing with somebody that was, and that alarm goes off, and just seeing it kicks my mind and puts me in a different state. So, you know, whatever form your spirituality takes, you know, you got to have that in the mix, you know, keep yourself healthy from head to toe.
Yeah, definitely. Cool, man. Good stuff, man. First, the last question, over this course of this conversation, is there anything that we didn't cover that you would like to address the young brothers or maybe just anyone even seeking a career change?
Be adventurous. You know, I have a friend, she's got an MBA, and she's a smart young lady, and she was frustrated. She moved here from Ohio. She had never been fired from a job in her life. She got a job working at a doctor's office. Got fired. She went out. She got a real estate license. And she never really did anything with it. So she's working at a doctor's office, and she wasn't happy with what she was doing, and she was complaining. I mean, every time I talked to her, she was complaining. And I told her, you have an MBA and a real estate license, and you're relatively young. If you're going to take that jump now.
Yeah.
You know, be a little adventurous. You know, I say to my young people, there's 1,000 different career paths, and it's hard. It's hard kind of figuring out, you know, where you go, which direction you want to go. Because people will tell you, like I told you earlier, the world will make you what the world thinks it wants you to be, right? But within that, there's so many opportunities. You know, I started refereeing just to get out of the house, right? And out of that, I've developed a whole, you know, full-time side hustle. Some of my best friends that I have come out of that. It's opened up other opportunities. You know, I got to go to the Big 12 Big 12 championship game and be on the field.
Yeah.
And it was all because I went online one day and said, hey, you know, I want to be a referee. Mm-hmm. I got into logistics. I was student teaching. And just out of the blue, you know, a buddy called me and said, you know what? You would be good at this job. And I went on one interview and doubled my salary. And I never looked back. So, you know, and don't pigeonhole yourself. I told you a story of my daughter's mom. She was a 16-year-old mom who dropped out of high school. And according to the world, that makes you a failure. You're a statistic. I was an 18-year-old man, right? And because of the strong parents that we had, her strong parents, my strong mother, we weren't allowed to fall into that trap. We were made to be parents. You know, I went to Sam Houston State. I can remember my mom dropping my daughter off at Sam Houston State and me having to hustle and take care of her.
Yeah.
And then her mom goes back to school, comes and gets her PA. You know, so you don't have to have it nailed the first shot out of the box.
Yeah.
You know, you can literally, you know, you can literally jump into something new at any given point. But you just have to be true to who you are, trust that you can trust, and build a strong net.
Mm-hmm.
Everything I am is because of my network. It's because of guys like you. It's because, you know, I have a strong mom. It's because of my fraternity brothers that keep me in check. You know, build your strong network. That enables you to jump out a little.
Yeah.
Because they're going to give you some advice, and they're going to be there to push you back up if you fall short.
See, you know, and this is why I wanted to interview, because I really think, I know you had made a comment earlier where the people I interview probably got it all figured out, but you'll find a commonality among us is we didn't know what to do. You know, we didn't know. And what I try to preach to my sons is you're not limited to anything. You're limited to your creativity. Anything you want to be, you know, just let me know. I'm not one of these guys that's going to try to push you down one road. But if you let me know your ambitions, I'm going to champion for you. I'm going to fight for you. I'm going to open these doors for you. So I think it's good for kids to, and even young men, man, to hear your story and look at you now, see how successful you are in your family life, well traveled. He has a slick car, y'all. I love his car.
T'Challa, baby.
Hey, T'Challa. I might get a picture of his car and put it up on the website, because he said, I was at work one day and he sent me a picture. He came and got it detailed at the job and it was parked sideways. And I was like,
you know, that was my graduation gift. Not my graduation gift. When Parker graduated from high school, that was my graduation gift to myself for being such a good dad.
Hey, you deserve it. You deserve it, brother. That thing is clean, boy. Ooh, that's clean. But yeah, man, I love you, man. I appreciate you. And I'm so glad you were able to carve some time out for me and share your story. Is there anything else you want to share? I don't know if you got any projects you're working on or
I'm trying to, my biggest thing is the people around me and getting them through this whole COVID thing. You know, the lockdown hit me hard and you know the backstory.
Yeah.
With my mom and with my sister being locked down. So, you know, the projects that I have most are keeping the people around me kind of proper and keeping myself.
Yeah.
The only thing I would add is you and I go back, man. I feel like we go back to South.
Yeah.
And you and I exchange a million emails. And that's one thing that men in general, but specifically Black men, are just real, you know, with all these things that went on with the whole George Floyd thing, the thing that I really wanted to get out, some of those conversations that I had with guys like you, I wish those could be public, because they feed our soul. You know, I suffer with anxiety and I have depression because I spend so much of my energy pumping other people up that I forget to feel my own.
Yeah.
So, you know, the only thing I want to leave is I love you, brother. You're an inspiration to me. Your family's an inspiration to me. And I wish that everybody within the sound of our voice can find a guy like you or a guy that's like our Black Mount Rushmore, that they can have real, open, honest conversations, so they can speak it into the universe and help them make themselves.
I appreciate that, man. Well, man, you be safe out here, man. You know, I'm going to talk to you probably 5 minutes after this is over with. But...
Yeah.
All right, brother.
We're gonna have to. I mean, your wheels are kind of slick too. I need to get over there so we can race.
See if I still got it, though.
See if you still got it, man. I've kind of pushed T'Challa to the limit a little bit, so we need to get over there and see if we can maybe put some pink slips on the line or something.
All right. All right, brother, man. You be safe out there, man.
All right, you be safe, right, man. Thanks care. A lot. All right, man.
Hope these authentic stories show different paths to success and provide mentorship. Please be sure to visit us at drjinterviews.com for additional content and social media info. Stay resilient.